Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
There's a great deal of talk today about happiness, the pursuit of happiness, well-being. How do we flourish? How and where is it all to be found? It's only really emerged on our radar over the last 5 or so years, and now it seems it's everywhere, even now on stage, with the latest play from Australia's favourite and most prolific playwright, David Williamson. It's simply called Happiness. We'd also love you to join us on Happiness on 1300 40 20 20. Where do you find it? Give us that defining moment, maybe, when it all comes together and you can say, that's when I'm happy, or that's what makes me happy. Is it a worthwhile pursuit, as all the experts in psychology seem to be telling us? Is it something that requires an active pursuit, time, space, a bit of clear air from everything else? Where is that defining moment of happiness for you? Well-being. What is that moment? Love you to share it with us. You may well open a door or window of happiness for the rest of us in this open house conversation. Maybe there are higher, more significant pursuits than happiness. Share your thoughts with us on 1300 40 20 20. David Williamson's new play kicked off a couple of days ago at the Ensemble Theatre in Sydney, where it's playing until early July. Then it moves to Noosa in Queensland. I was honoured to get some time with this Australian icon. And as you'll hear, our conversation took a surprising turn that I expect will be making news from this interview. David Williamson, welcome to Open House.
Pleasure to be here, Lee.
It's great to have you with us. This began for you with an invitation to address a happiness conference a couple of years ago. It got you thinking both about your own happiness and the often complex process of finding it.
Absolutely. One of the guest speakers who was on before me was Martin Seligman, who is sort of the world guru of current happiness theory. I mean, there have been happiness theories since the Greeks and further back. But what is available now is a body of actual research with data that actually fairly well identifies the factors that do make you happy in life, as distinct from some weird theory that's just pulled out of the top of the head. And Martin was very convincing. But being a dramatist, I couldn't help thinking when I was watching him, now what if this man who knows everything about what makes humans happy was having a really rough time in his own private life? So I invented a wife that was a little difficult to handle and a daughter that was just as difficult to handle. And my professor, Roland Makepeace, has to deal with his family and his theory and his practice don't quite line up.
So everything's falling apart in his own life, but he's the expert on happiness.
He is. Well, I wouldn't say it was falling apart, but he's having difficulties.
And yet it's a funny play. Why do you think people are laughing at it?
I do think that there's a satirical edge to a lot of what I write, and there is in this one. In fact, I sent the play to Martin Seligman because I met him at the conference and said, look, I hope you don't think I've been too terrible. And he said, look, I can accept the edge of satire. He said, that's fine. At least you got the theory right. The theory makes sense. I mean, it's not a stupid, it's not a weird philosophical theory. It's just common basic sense.
So what's the theory? What's he saying?
He's saying that research shows there are five main factors that make you happy as a human being, which is summarized by the letters PERMA, P-E-R-M-A. P is trying to organize your life to get as much positive emotion in as you can. E is engagement, which means try and find something to do in life which fully engages you, so that time flies instead of dragging. R is for relationships. Unless you have good family relationships and good friendship relationships, you're not going to be happy. M is meaning, and a lot of the research shows that the most lasting happiness is when you're actually altruistic, when you do something for other people without thought for your personal gain, except that it makes you feel better, and it certainly does. And A is good old-fashioned achievement. People still need to find something in life they do that other people hopefully admire.
That's the theory. How hard is it to put it into practice? I suppose that's partly what the play is about.
It is. It is. It's difficult, but if you do look at your life carefully, and there are very, very good and well-researched questionnaires you can fill in to see which areas you're not doing well on. And there are things you can do to try and increase them. I mean, if you're on the materialistic treadmill, for instance, which many people are, they just need to keep earning more and more money to buy more and more goods to display the fact that their status is higher than someone else's, it's a self-defeating cycle. It goes on forever because there's always someone that's doing better than you are. So if you spend your life trying to get to the top of the ladder, you're never going to get there and you're going to be miserable, even though you've got your Mercedes in the garage or maybe two or maybe three. The research shows the effect of buying a new Mercedes, the happiness wears off after roughly 3 or 4 weeks. You just get used to it. But if you do something decent for someone else, the effect lasts for much, much longer.
Has it been a good personal experience for you, having a look at it and perhaps looking at your own life?
Yes, it has. I've always been too heavy on the achievement end of the scale. I wanted to be a prominent playwright and have my plays seen by people. Well, that's fine.
You've got there.
Well, I've got there. So a bit more meaning doing things for other people, which you can do, is needed. Relationships, luckily, are good. I've got a great family and good friends, so I just need to a bit less on achievement and a few of the other factors come up, or try and make them come up.
Why do you think we're talking about happiness so much, say, over the last 5 to 10 years?
Because it's a huge puzzle. As our professor in the play tonight says, we're actually 3 times richer in real terms than we were 40 years ago, yet all the studies show that depression is greater now than it was back then. Nobody can make sense of that, because everybody's made this simplistic assumption that economists do, that the more goodies you have, the happier you are. And it just doesn't work like that. Look, being poor doesn't make you happy, but beyond a certain level, chasing more material goods and more status symbols certainly doesn't make you happy. It's driven by status anxiety. People feel that they're a failure unless they have a bigger car than the next door neighbours. But that's self-defeating. In the end, it goes on forever.
In your fabulously successful and prolific career, it's been built on a curiosity about people. I've heard you describe it as an obsession you have, about why people behave as they do in social situations. What's driven that? What have you found out about them?
Look, I think it goes back to my family. Kristen, when she first met my mother and father, said there was no other career I could have but a dramatist's, because there was drama in our family every day of the week. And not just gentle conflict sometimes. There was never physical conflict, but my God, there was psychological warfare going on ad infinitum. Kristen found it amusing. My brother and I didn't. we felt we were in a perpetual battleground. And so I think at some deep level I was driven to find out, why are people at each other's throats? What's the source of conflict? And conflict, as you know, is the source of all drama. So the two things sort of dovetail.
And in the work you've done, delving into that and exploring so many dynamics of the human condition, you've actually been doing the work in a way of a psychologist, gloriously, without the need to fix them necessarily.
No, I don't do much fixing. Usually the people in my plays muddle through at the end, and that's the basis of comedy or satire, that people are never perfect. They keep repeating the same mistakes, but they muddle through. But yes, in fact, after I graduated as an engineer, which I was not interested in, I went on to do an MA prelim in psychology at Melbourne University, and found that this is really what I wanted to do. And I did well enough to embark on the start of postgraduate studies, and I was reappointed at Swinburne to teach psychology, and I would have been very happy doing that. It's just that what I'm doing on stage is similar to the kinds of explorations I would have been trying to do as a psychologist.
In so many ways, through so many of your plays, you've been shining a light on the posturing and, in a way, the acting that we all engage in. Why do we do that?
I think social behaviour is a kind of psychic dance. We're juggling all kinds of things, but the three main components of human nature are a fairly profound selfishness, unfortunately, that our needs come before anyone else's, then our families, then our friends, and then the rest of the world. But we're also very social creatures. We like to be liked, admired, and even loved by other people. And thirdly, most of us are compassionate human beings. We don't enjoy other people being in misery. That's why we donate to starvation funds and things like that. We're trying to pretend we're not as selfish, in fact, as we are, so people won't hate us because we are social creatures and we don't want them to hate us. And we don't like to push our selfishness beyond a certain level because it hurts other people, unless you're a psychopath, and there are those out there that don't give a damn. But most of us don't like hurting other people. So it's a juggle. You're pushing your own egocentric interests. You're still trying to remain liked and loved by your friends and acquaintances. And you're trying not to hurt anybody.
In so many ways, and in so many of your plays, you're lifting the veil on that, and that can be a confronting thing for us to realise what we're really like. You're helping us to be, in a way, honest with ourselves.
I hope so. It's I'm not morally lecturing anyone, I hope. I'm just saying, look, this is the way I think it is. This is the intricate social dance we all do, and often we ourselves are blind to some of the things we're doing. In fact, a lot of the recognition in the audience is recognizing that that is how we actually behave, and the humour is that the character on stage doesn't realise they're being quite as bad as we, the audience, know they are.
Is there a sweet spot for you in your life where you can say, that is when I'm the happiest?
Well, increasingly, I'm just saying what most people say. As you get older, you realise that the treadmill of status and acquisition isn't of lasting benefit, and family, friends, and hopefully some altruistic behaviour. One of my acquaintances is a very successful businessman, and yet the thing he is most proud of is that he has gone to third world countries and actually built infrastructure, even simple things like toilets that are absolutely desperately needed. And I won't say he bores us, but he loves to show us the pictures of his assorted toilets that he's put up all around, and other projects to help other people. So I hope I can do a bit more of that.
In how you've looked at happiness through Seligman, through the conference, your writing and thinking about this, have you found a faith or a spiritual dimension that's part of it?
No, look, I find religion can obviously lead to happiness for some people, a need to believe in something bigger than oneself, in something beyond the life we're living, is a very real and understandable need. I personally can't believe it, and I don't think I could become happy putting my faith in an everlasting life. I mean, this life is grueling enough to think of having to live an everlasting one. Would singing hymns or something would be beyond belief. So I can't bring myself to believe the tenets of most religions. If there was a religion I have admiration for, it would be the religion that was behind the happiness conference. That's the Buddhist religion that actually tries to teach people not to find happiness in material acquisitions. That way is not the way to peace and tranquility and happiness.
You've described yourself in your work as an addict, that it's just got you hooked and you can't let go.
Yeah, I have been like that. Look, you don't do it for the money. You don't even do it for the recognition, although that's nice. But what you really do it for is getting a group of actors together, some chemistry happening between them and the audience, and something happening out there on stage that's relating to people's lives. That's the big buzz that I get addicted to. But look, I'm in my 70s, early 70s, thank goodness, now, and I still think I'm writing as well, or hope I am writing as well as ever. You know, look, I've done 42 years of work now. It's out there. People are reviving the plays, so I don't feel as driven as I did when I was 30 or 40.
Can I ask you how your health is? You had a health scare a few years ago, which initially forced you into retirement. I'm sure that concentrated the mind wonderfully.
Yes, I had a thing called atrial fibrillation where the heart, not always, but intermittently, sometimes goes into the wrong rhythms, and that can cause, if it's not watched, that can cause a blood clot. And sure enough, a couple of weeks ago, it did, and I found myself sitting in a restaurant with my wife, and suddenly my right arm and right leg ceased to work, and my right side of the mouth, and it was the biggest wake-up call I ever got. I realised instantly I was suffering a stroke, and luckily I was zipped off to hospital by a very efficient medical system, I must say. An ambulance came in no time at all, and they were talking to the St. Vincent's as I was on the way, and they managed to pump the anti-clotting drug into me in the two-hour window of opportunity before your brain cells die. And so I've been left with no permanent deficit except a slight balance problem when I'm tired or when I drink too much. But I was incredibly lucky. That made me feel right. I was working on a very big project, and I just, the next day, finish. No, I can't do it anymore. But now I'm on the right drugs, and it shouldn't happen again. But it's certainly when your brain tells your limbs to do something and they won't, it's the biggest wake-up, because it happens so quickly. Boom, it's just there, boom. It happens so quickly that I thought, no, no more pressure. For heaven's sake, take the right drugs. I'd been putting that off, and now I should be okay. But, yeah, mortality crowds in a little.
So will this be retirement for you then?
Yeah, virtually I think so this time. I think, look, I might do a play or two occasionally, but certainly it won't be under stress conditions. It won't be to deadlines. And my family has actually put the foot down and has forbidden me. See, that's lucky. I've got a friendship and family network, and they tell me I'm an idiot, and so stop doing it. And I will. I will. Look, I've, as I said, I've done 42 years worth of work, and I'm not desperately striving to achieve something anymore.
And you're still standing.
My leg and arm are doing what I tell them again, which is like a miracle. When they pump the stuff into me and you feel suddenly your arm and leg are coming back after 20 minutes, it was an immense relief.
David Williamson, I'm so pleased and so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for joining us on Open House, and wish you well for the future.
A pleasure, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.